Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And very special today, Hal Levinson is with us. Boy, some stuff to learn. Have you ever felt that you have to get better organized? Did you ever say to yourself, what's the matter with me? I always am catching up from the, in this mess. I have a mess all around me. Somehow my mind just doesn't want to get organized. That's the kind of thing that people suffer with over and over again. And if I get to hear the one criticism that I've heard the most from people, it's this one about, I must get better organized. Well, that's a very funny thing, because I'm not organized, and I don't think I have to get better organized. But there are people for whom it's much more difficult than other people to pull things in order. Dr. Harold N. Levinson is a specialist in treating dyslexia, but he understands dyslexia and phobias in a way that I think you're going to find very unique and very helpful to the people you know who may suffer with some sense of this. Hal, welcome to WBAI.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Hal, let's start this off. Well, I guess we should start it off with the fact that you are the author of a new book called Smart But Feeling Dumb. And that's kind of a very interesting title, but it's perfect. Could you describe why you chose that title?
After examining probably 35,000 children, adults, and even seniors over 30 to 40 years, I came to recognize that a whole bunch of individuals who have reading and writing and spelling and math and memory problems and organization problems, what they all feel in common is they all feel dumb, klutzy and dumb and stupid, irregardless of their IQ, and even often irregardless of what other people expect of them and what other people say to them. It's an instinctive response based very often on their IQ versus their performance. If they're bright, the brighter they are, the more frustrated they get with their performance if they're not excelling, and the dumber they feel. And so I tried to capture the essence of a wide range of symptoms that very few people have ever linked together.
All right, so let's talk about some of those symptoms that people haven't linked together.
Well, what I found basically is that everything that was thought about dyslexia and even ADHD is wrong or significantly incomplete.
Can we start off with just a definition of dyslexia for people who don't know?
The definition of dyslexia was crazy. You had to be two or more years behind your peers to qualify for this diagnosis. Not 1.9, not 1.8. And if, God forbid, you had a great teacher and you fell from 2 to 1.9, you were learning disabled instead of dyslexic. And then if you had a bad teacher,
the distinction,
you became dyslexic again. So it made no sense.
So the distinction between learning disabled, which means, well, you're just not as fast as the other kids, and then dyslexia, if you fall behind by a certain percentage.
Yes, like.
And dyslexia means what? What does it mean?
Strictly speaking, it means reading problem, severe reading problem. That's sort of equivalent to mistakenly thinking that diabetes is a comatose state, and it omits all the non-comatose diabetics. So the old traditional definition that's probably now 100 years old is based on comatose reading impairments, severe, not mild, but severe.
Not learning disorder, but reading disorder.
Right, and I have come to recognize, just by speaking, I was psychoanalytically trained, and I always said, if I don't understand something, I ask people questions. And I asked hundreds and hundreds of children questions. How is your reading and writing and spelling? And sure enough, I came to recognize that over many, many years, that there are 13 or 15 major areas of functions that could be included under the title of dyslexia. And severity of function has nothing to do with this problem. You can be a mild reader. You can even be an over-accomplished reader and still be dyslexic, just like you can be diabetic with a low blood sugar.
So even something like I've known people who claim they were dyslexic with numbers.
Yes.
Right? And they reverse numbers, and they do things like that. They consider that, I mean, by the definition of dyslexia being a reading disorder, is that necessarily, does that fall under that definition, or would we have another word for it?
Well, what people did is, because they didn't understand the whole concept, they labeled every symptom by a different name. So if you had a reading problem, they called it dyslexia. If you had a writing problem, they called it dysgraphia. If you had a balance and coordination or rhythmic problem, they called it dyspraxia. If you had a math problem, they called it dyscalculia. If you had a speech problem, which is all part and parcel of this syndrome, they called it dysphasia or dysnomia or various other aspects of a speech problem. And if you had concentration and disorganization problems, they would label you ADD. If you had hyperactivity and impulsivity, you were hyperactive. And if you had a combination, you were ADHD. So that also...
Slow that down just a second, because really, I'm sure for many people, they're hearing it for the first time. The ADD and the ADHD distinction. If you're disorganized and you can't pull your life together, ADD, attention deficit disorder, because you can't pay attention long enough, is that what it is?
Well, that's what they call it.
What do they call it, yes?
They call it a symptom of ADHD, but they don't understand what causes the symptom, the underpin of it.
But the definition, the difference between ADD and ADHD, what's the difference?
It's hyperactivity. If you just have a concentration problem, they call it ADD, attention deficit disorder. If you also have hyperactivity with it, it's called attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Okay, so that's the ADHD, where we have the evident, the nervousness that goes with it, the anxiety that goes with it.
The activity level.
Okay. So now all of these have been put, because we have a label, it gives us a chance to sell a drug, right? So now we have to go invent a new chemical to treat each one of these different symptoms.
Well,
and I'm sure they have different chemicals for dysphagia as they do for dyslexia. You know, it's a different, take this new thing. But I know you don't believe that that's the approach. What have you found that you have in common with all of these? What's the commonality you found? What did you ask questions about that nobody else was really questioning?
Basically, the dyslexic syndrome or the reading problem was thought to be an impairment within a processor in the thinking brain. There's a reading processor. You send clear written signals into the brain visually or acoustically by sound, and the brain should normally interpret it. If there's a specific impairment, it's called the angular gyrus, is impaired, it was thought that it won't recognize normally seen letters and words. Then there was another area of the brain that has to do primarily with writing, another with spelling, another with math, another with memory, and another with coordination, and on it goes. It turns out that probably 98% of my patients have a wide combination of symptoms affecting reading, writing, spelling, math, memory, speech, sense of direction and time, including organization, concentration, distractibility, impulsivity, and a whole slew of phobias, as well as psychosomatic symptoms like headaches, dizziness, motion sickness, and as a mentioned self-esteem difficulties, even body image difficulties. So what I then said to myself, if every symptom had an area of the brain impaired, you'd have to have minus 2,000 IQ. And yet they say Einstein, Edison, Da Vinci, Patton, they can name gifted geniuses with dyslexia and variations. So there can't be anything wrong with the processor, because you'd have to have too many processing impairments to account for the symptoms. And they couldn't get better if the processes were primarily impaired. So what I recognized was that what characterized all these individuals when you examined them neurologically was not anything wrong with the thinking brain, which was previously thought since 1896 and before. Rather, I found these kids had some difficulty with balance, coordination, and rhythm. They were late walkers, late crawlers, late sitters. They had enunciation problems, stuttering, stammering. They would forget the letter or the word when they were pronouncing it. They who are accident-prone, tripping, falling, bumping, fine motor coordination when they were younger, gross or rhythmic coordination, some difficulty with balance and coordination. And the eureka moment was after examining about 1,000 consecutive children and reanalyzing their data, I said, maybe all they have is something wrong with their inner ear and the supercomputer called the cerebellum, the lower brain, which governs balance, coordination, and rhythm, because that's all we found. And then I said, if the inner ear acts as a fine-tuner to the brain and fine-tunes all sensory signals coming into the brain and all balance or motor signals going out of the brain, then we can explain a tremendous amount of symptoms. Because if channel one gets the scrambled signal, and that's the reading channel, we get reading problems. If it's the writing channel, we get writing problems. If it's the spelling or the math or the memory. So we could explain why you can get hundreds of different symptoms from one problem without impairing IQ, because the thinking brain is intact. But it can recognize signals coming in that are scrambled sound-wise or visual. And the severity of the symptom would depend significantly on the degree of scrambling. So we can account for even that variation that no other theory could.
So you're kind of saying, hey, you know, we boiled it all. I said, let's look for a common cause here. And instead of looking at brain damage, instead of looking at inconsistencies in the brain itself, you looked at the inner ear, and you said,
I was forced to. I looked where everybody else looked, and I found nothing like everybody else found. The only difference is they stuck to the theory. They said, we just can't find it, it's there. And I said, if nobody else found it, and I didn't find a problem within the thinking brain, maybe it's not there.
Well, we know enough about the inner ear that it could affect all of your balance, that you could affect your sense of balance, your whole kinesthetic sense in general. And you're saying, by examining the balance a little closer and by treating, I guess you could actually treat that, you could probably deal with a lot of these symptoms.
Yes.
Instead of by trying to treat the damaged brain as the primary symptom.
The damaged thinking brain.
And it turns out
that the supercomputer for the inner ear called the cerebellum, now that's the brain of an animal. It's the highest brain of an animal in the reflex brain of man. Now think of what an animal is capable of doing. They have tremendous sensory motor control to a large extent, much of it better than us. They communicate to some extent or other. They certainly have memory patterns that we seldom pay attention to. They can learn words. If you have a smart dog, and anybody has seen, you can train animals to do many things and understand many things. All of this is located in the cerebellum because they don't have a thinking brain. The cerebellum is their thinking brain. So the cerebellum in man is capable of doing all these functions. It's sort of like a CEO of a company having a brilliant secretary, sending him information and handling the outgoing decisions and information. If the secretary messes up, the boss won't know what the hell's going on, and the output is going to be terrible.
So this is Armand DeMille with Dr. Harold Levinson, who has written Smart But Feeling Dumb, kind of a very unique and exciting book about dramatic approaches to many disorders, including dyslexia, ADD, LD. Let's just for the sake of taking a little exciting moment, you mentioned before we got on air, you mentioned something about phobias. And we've been looking at some of the work on phobias just recently. And phobias have always been enigmatic to most therapists. You know, we all say we know how to cure them. And we can either do it by flooding or desensitization or any number of treatments or interpretation. But you've taken a different approach to this, and you've kind of finally, you know, you've gotten yourself some kind of a possible way direction with them. Could you talk about your experience with phobias?
Yeah, basically, I was psychoanalytically trained, and I really never understood why certain people had a fear of heights. And the psychological interpretation was that people were afraid of falling. They were either afraid of success or failure, and that's the reason they were afraid of heights, except it didn't work out in clinical practice. None of the phobias that people came to me for were psychologically explainable unless you forced them into a theory that didn't fit or forced them into a box that was inappropriate. When I started treating patients that had dyslexia, typical dyslexic symptoms, reading, writing, spelling, math, memory, concentration, with inner ear improving medications and nutrients, not only did the reading and writing improve, but suddenly, patients were telling me, I'm no longer afraid of heights, I'm no longer afraid of elevators or trains or planes or buses, no longer afraid of driving, I'm not afraid of leaving my house. And I suddenly recognized that if the dyslexic syndrome was inner ear determined, and inner ear medications improved the inner ear symptoms I knew, like dizziness and motion sickness and balance and the reading and writing mechanisms, which hopefully we'll have time to go into. I said, well, then maybe the phobias have an inner ear origin that nobody ever paid attention to. I then said to myself, well, if your balance is off, and that's an inner ear mechanism, it would simply explain why people are afraid of heights. And if their visual processing is off, as well as their balance, if they look down from a height, it's going to magnify the imbalance. And so it would explain even height phobias that are only present when you're looking down, many of which then have what patients describe as a magnetic tug. They feel they're pulled to the ground. Their eyes lock into the target, and they're compelled to jump, so they fall to the knees and back off. Some complain of suicide. They almost want to jump and get it over with. And many a clinician was fooled and thought these patients were depressed and suicidal when in fact they were terrified of falling.
Well, how about could you also explain something like fear of cockroaches or fear of snakes that way?
Yes.
How?
Well, once I had explained the common phobias, for example, and those I'll get to in a second if you don't mind. I then recognized that there's a motion phobia for every form of motion sickness. Moving elevators, escalators, trains, planes, buses, can't be an accident that these are all forms of motion that are inner ear determined, and that some people are afraid or more motion sick on elevators or trains or planes or buses and even certain positions in a car. There's some individuals that only get motion sick in the back seat of a car. They have to be in the front seat. They have to drive. That it was always taught that they had to be in control. All they had to do was be in control of the inner ear, not necessarily in control of everybody else, but this wasn't understood. As I began to understand the inner ear, the common inner ear mechanisms responsible for almost all phobias, including driving, which has a coordination and a visual element. Many driving phobias, people are afraid, especially at high speeds or driving on highways, because at higher speed, they feel, first of all, their speed perception is off. They think they're going 10 times faster than they are, and they see cars coming at them 10 times faster than they are, and they also don't see parallels properly. They see the cars coming at them crossing the line, when in fact, they're going in parallel directions. And they feel they don't have the coordination skills to handle the car when it's moving faster and faster. So we could explain agoraphobia and travel phobias and on and on. But then I was left with the puzzling concept, why are people afraid of, for example, snakes? Never having seen one. They live in New York City. They never went to the zoo. They open a book. They see a form. It looks like a snake, and they panic. They actually get a panic attack. And many people call them universal phobias because they're so common, irregardless of countries and societies. They're all over the world. And then I recognized, you know what they must be? They must be determined by our phylogeny or our past, our evolutionary past. There was an animal. Most animals are frightened and attack certain shapes, certain smells, certain configurations, whether they're cockroaches or birds or snakes, it sounds an alarm to some animal form or other. And what happens is, as human beings, over development, over an evolutionary time span, we inherit a lot of those alarm systems and aggressive responses, but they're inhibited, they're suppressed. We don't know they're there because they serve no current adaptive function for a human being. However, when you have an impairment in the inner ear and the cerebellum, you get what's called an impairment in inhibition, blockage. There's an impaired suppression of certain reflexes, just like impulsive children are impulsive because they can't control their actions. There's a blockage.
Wait, just back that up for a moment for me, Al. Thank you. Some of us have fears of snakes and some of us don't. You're saying that the group of us that don't have the fear of snakes have what? They have the ability to disinhibit?
Yes. No, to inhibit.
To inhibit
that reflex response to a certain shape, a certain.
So given push comes to shove, all of us are afraid of snakes.
Potentially.
Because we inherited that part of us that knew that the snake was dangerous, and so was any animal running in our direction with gnarling teeth.
Yes, and the difference is when it leaks through, it leaks through the suppression, and out comes a crazy thought or crazy fear that nobody was able to explain. Just like certain obsessive thoughts that people have. Mm. The thought leaks out. We all are susceptible to it. Like in a dream. In a dream, when you're asleep, the suppression or inhibition lessens, and so you have all sorts of weird things coming up in a dream, some scary, some not in proper sequence. It's almost like a dyslexic reality when you're dreaming. Everything is out of shape in terms of time and space and whatnot, and it seems perfectly all right. When we wake up, the dream state is suppressed, and reality takes over, except when we're tired. And out pops certain weird thoughts and feelings that we have that we can't understand.
How interesting. You know, I was talking to a man the other day who's a bartender. He said, you know, there's amazing, there's two kinds of people at the bar. People who get drunk and they're happy, and people who get drunk who are scared. He said, in the minute that they get drunk, they talk about fears all the time. You know, I shouldn't get drunk, I shouldn't do this, this is going to happen, and they're all negative. He said, then there's another group who when they drink, they're totally disinhibited. Now, this leading to your hypothesis here, it's like kind of interesting. You're meaning that as some people lose their ability to put aside, you know, their fear of things when they're drinking. So there is a mechanism that stops them from using their rational mind to control their fears.
Yes.
Fascinating
and
stuff.
It's a biological mechanism. And some people, for example, become very aggressive when they drink.
Right.
And their aggressive instincts are released. It's like a seizure. They can't control themselves.
Because normally we'd be able to inhibit those impulses.
Exactly.
And with phobias, normally you could inhibit those fears.
Exactly.
But in almost every phobia, well, you got to really see the John Vassos. We were looking at this book by John Vassos, who's a man who decided in the 1921 to write about phobias with the most beautiful graphics that he described all of the fears. It's wonderful. But all of these fears that we have, they're all kind of normal. You're saying, oh, yeah, that's a normal fear, exaggerated.
Yes.
So your fear of, I remember somebody, one of my patients, had a fear of open-ended pipes, I remember, just seeing pipes on a truck. And you're saying somewhere in there, that open-ended pipe is triggering some sense memory of something that was truly a danger.
Yes, and it didn't have to be an emotional trauma necessarily. It didn't have to be a sexual trauma or an aggressive trauma, as many psychoanalysts thought. To give you an interesting example, Fenichel was one of Freud's brilliant disciples.
Good old Otto.
Yes.
Back.
And in his book, he states a correlation between fears of heights, moving phobias, dizziness, and motion sickness. And what he says is there's an inner ear problem, and the neuroses that follow, namely the fears, are due to a sexualization of the inner ear during early childhood.
Whoa.
He was 100% correct, but he complicated a clinical observation by forcing it into a sexualization aspect.
Well, that was at his time. That was the whole focus. That was the whole Freud focus.
Yes.
The sexualization became the whole major thing, a fascinating thing.
But what Freud said, too, is behind every neurotic phenomena is what's called a somatic compliance. There's a physiological or somatic basis. And what my research has come to recognize is much of the somatic basis is an overlooked problem within the inner ear and a supercomputer, the cerebellum. So that now we can better understand a lot of so-called psychological symptoms, as well as why so many different methods of therapy can work for disorganization as well as phobias. It depends what level you're treating the problem at. In other words, if you're trying to block the seepage, the inhibition, from the outside down, you say, forget about what the cause is because they don't know it. Let's try using the thinking brain to suppress it. Let's condition it. Let's use your powers of being, your powers of thinking and repetition to block the holes creating the linkage. And you get a certain rate of improvement. And other people have said, let's use serotonin inhibitors, because that lessens the anxiety response. So if you lessen the anxiety response, the normal control mechanisms of the body can very often take over. But if you understand the inner ear mechanisms that trigger it, you can perfect the treatment on whichever end you're using it.
So this is Armand DeMille with Hal Levinson, M.D., wrote a book, Smart But Feeling Dumb. We're talking about dyslexia and other disorders that could be possibly related to inner ear disturbance. What do you mean Dramamine could be the answer to a lot of problems?
Very much so. For example, the astronauts.
Dramamine, for sure.
The astronauts at zero gravity started reading upside down and backwards. And I can render every one of your listening audience temporarily dyslexic, temporarily disorganized, temporarily ADHD.
Boy, you're the kind of guy we don't want to get pissed off. You mean you could just do a spell on us and make us...
Yeah, it's a very, very simple instructive spell.
What's your spell?
Turn around and spin around till you're dizzy. Once you get dizzy, you won't be able to read straight, write straight, talk straight, think straight. Your concentration is going to be off. Your balance and coordination is going to be off. You're going to feel foggy and off key. And you're not going to be able to function in reality so well. What you're going to do is sit down and hide until the dizzy spell is over. Well, you don't have to have the dizziness to have your signals scrambled.
Mm-hmm.
The dizziness is a symptom of signal scrambling.
Wow.
So we can create this problem, and it also happens after sinus infections and ear infections. People who never had these problems suddenly develop them, and they go to doctors and they say it's impossible. Mononucleosis, Lyme's disease, whiplash injuries commonly affect the inner ear. The neck is an integration point for the inner ear system. So if you have an impairment of your neck, a whiplash, what happens is doctors only treat the physical symptoms, and they attribute all the other symptoms that don't have structure, like bone and muscle and tendons, as if they were psychological, never realizing that the memory difficulties that occur after whiplash, the concentration problems, the difficulty reading. And it's not that they don't complain that they're dyslexic. They say that they lost their interest in reading and writing. They just don't read. They're not interested in conversing anymore. They don't have the patience to listen to conversations or to a long movie or to a lecture. So what they do is they temporarily acquire either dyslexia or ADHD, but it's due to a basic inner ear problem that's caused by an acquired condition, either a concussion, a mild concussion. The severe concussions, you can explain a lot of things, but overlooked are the severe consequences of even minor concussions and whiplash injuries or falls.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Harold Levinson. We are talking about dyslexia and inner ear disturbance related to it. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this with a further investigation. We'll be joined by Linda Vanella as well, and we'll be looking at some of the possible solutions to this. Do stay with us, my friend. Lou Donaldson, Blues Walk. You know, I remember so well that when, in my earlier days, the jazz world, and I would be hanging out with a bunch of jazz musicians, as I was an aspiring one myself at one point. And one of the things we found is it was perfectly all right if you couldn't follow, if you didn't even read music. You could be a fine musician. And that became fascinating, because there were a lot of guys who couldn't string two notes together if they were, but they were great when they didn't.
It's very, very interesting you mention that. I have gifted dyslexics, one in music, for example, a professor and was talented in about five or six instruments, is a conductor, couldn't read when he came to me, but he can hear the whole thing in his head. I can't hear the whole thing in my head. I can't hear too much in my head at all. But I can't play. He didn't need it. It was there. And
how do you account for that?
He had a tremendous gift to absorb the sound and remember it better and faster and more accurately than if he read. And I always wondered, for example, why do conductors turn the pages? They can't turn the page fast enough, especially in a choral group. You got 100 musicians playing, you got 100 people singing. They can hear every single thing, anticipate it, and many of them don't have to turn it. I think it's just they're taught to do it by people who don't have the skills of the conductor that's leading the orchestra. So I have artists, for example, who can write, but they do beautiful calligraphy. They can draw their writing. They can't reflexly write. It's illegible. I have mathematicians that can't add and subtract. They don't have the memory for the simple addition, subtraction, and multiplication, but they can conceptualize wonderfully.
Is your primary practice psychiatry or neurology? When you say you have...
Both.
So people who come to you... But now, I mean, people who come to you are, if they could find your phone number, are mostly dyslexic people. I mean, you're saying this is your specialty, right?
Well, it's my specialty, but I always have retained the ability and the desire to do psychotherapy. I had this enormous liking for what I did. I kept adding and adding, and apparently you do the same. And so what happens is I add and add until I get exhausted, and then I take a rest, and I start all over again. And everything new interests me, and when I come back, I have a better perspective of everything I've done before, even those things that seem initially unrelated.
Great, you're a Renaissance man. Linda Vidal is with us as well. Now, Linda, you deal with dyslexia a lot, both as a therapist, but also as a teacher, a professor, right?
Yes, I do. I have many students that I teach in the college level that will come to me, Hal, and will say to me, I've managed to be articulate, I've managed to retain my good grades in elementary and high school, but here I am in college where I would love to be able to perform better, but suddenly I feel that my organization skills are poor, my study habits certainly need some help. What would that be? What would be the cause of that, Hal?
It's the same underlying cause within the inner ear. Let me explain what happens. Some individuals are very, very bright, and they compensate. And teachers think just because somebody's reading on grade level or writing on grade level or concentrating more or less appropriate, they're normal, when in fact they're merely compensating because they have greater capabilities. As the workload gets more and more, as you have to absorb and remember and process information faster and faster, the mechanism starts to decompensate. It's like taking a glucose tolerance test to find a mild diabetic. But it breaks down, and people then think, well, they were perfectly normal during childhood, and here they're having problems for the first time in college. It's an emotional problem. It's a situational problem. They're on drugs, and on it goes. No, it's merely that the stress level, the computer can't handle all the processing capacity needed, because the compensation breaks down, they start to burn out, and then the impairment gets worse and worse. And let's say organization. What happens?
Wait, let me ask you a question related to that, because it's kind of interesting. Do you think that the natural state of being without our sense of organization is disorganized or organized?
That's disorganized. Take disorganized,
right?
Take a child. We're all children. We grow up. So we're all ADHD.
So primitive man would have been not organized. He would have been just, I got to deal with whatever happens when it happens.
Well, he dealt with one thing at a time. I mean, a couple of things at a time, eating and sleeping and a few other things, and that's it. And what happened is his brain didn't have to be so big. He didn't deal with a lot of things over an evolutionary time span or even a developmental time span. Look at a child. Children can't read, they can't talk, they can't walk properly, they're poorly coordinated, their concentration is off, they're very disorganized. So they have all the diagnostic terms that I talked about. What happens over age is they get more and more control mechanisms. They compensate. They outgrow the primitive being that they inherited, so to speak, and they become us. Unless they don't fully outgrow it,
and then
they have these disorders or symptoms.
When a person, you say there's an inner ear disorder, and we're going to have to talk about that itself. I mean, if you were to look at a person, what would you use? An X-ray machine? What would you do to try to find the disorder? Use CAT scans? Use 3D imaging? What do you use?
No, MRIs and CAT scans, believe it or not, show absolutely nothing. It's probably a neurochemical disturbance for most individuals on some level, but you do a neurological exam. First, a history. Sir William Osler was a brilliant clinician. He said history is 90% the diagnosis, providing you take a good one and know what questions to ask. Now, for diagnosis, you don't need CAT scans. They don't work. You need a simple neurological examination, and that works tremendously. And that's like the drunken driving test that people give you. And many, a dyslexic will fail it without any alcohol it can take. They have difficulty balancing on one foot. They can't hit their nose with their finger alternately. They can't rotate their arms forwards and backwards and sideways. They don't have the rhythm, and it looks very awkward if you watch. They can't walk a straight line heel to toe without falling to one side or another or mildly veering. It doesn't have to be tremendously impaired, although it can be surprisingly. But it's there. Then there are special inner ear tests that we do. One of them was discovered by Sir Robert Barony. Well, he got the Nobel Prize. But if you put water in the ears, the eyes go to one side. It causes a nystagmus. So if you put warm water in, the eyes go to one side. If you put cool water in, the eyes go to the opposite side. The absence or the severity or an impairment in this demonstrates the presence of an inner ear problem.
So it's like the knee jerk, you know, if the person doesn't respond when you hit them with a hammer in the knee, you're saying there's an impairment.
Yes.
And you put water in somebody's ear and their eyes don't move,
yeah,
you say possible disorder.
Right. And the inner ear plays a major role in eye movements. The most common symptom of reading disabled dyslexics is not reversing letters like B and D. It's losing your place when you read. They need a finger or marker. The words get blurry or double up or start to wiggle. They skip lines. And this is the most
common.
Sounds
like me under fatigue. So
yes.
That's exactly what you're saying.
Exactly. And so everyone, when they get fatigued enough, regresses to a dyslexic state.
Wow.
Or an ADD state. So just like we mentioned before with phobias, the predisposing tendencies are there. An infection can trigger it. Severe fatigue and stress can trigger it, as well as many other circumstances.
So you can't really examine and see it. You can just infer it.
You can examine it and infer it from the examination.
But you can't see. You don't see a little knot in the ear. You don't see anything wrong.
No, and you can't see it with an MRI. And I developed a very simple group of tests. For example, because I noticed that there was an eye tracking problem that individuals invariably have when they have reading problems and dyslexia, I first developed an instrument that can project on a screen, now it does it on a computer, moving words. And as you speed up the words, the eyes automatically chase it. It's called an optokinetic reflex. The eye automatically fixates and tracks it. But if you make the words go faster and faster, they blur out, very quickly at speeds a fourth and a fifth of that of a normal individual's. And then I use elephants because it's simpler for children to identify. And so I make the elephants run. And they start to run at speeds very, very low. The sequence blurs out. They can't see the elephants. And mm-hmm. Plus, I can do it. I can start with very fast-running elephants. They see a blur, and I can slow it down until they recognize it. And then it's called a recognition speed. And again, there are different instruments that I developed, one for vision, one for hearing, that does the same for hearing. Many individuals with this problem have telephone phobias. You know why they have a telephone phobia?
No, tell me.
Because they can't process sound well. And on a telephone, they can't see the facial expressions.
Of course.
Many of them read lips and face. Many of them also are slow to process what they hear, and they can't react fast enough verbally to the commands. They don't have a language problem. They have a speed problem in terms of communicating. The speed disrupts it, and they feel like an idiot. And if there are distractions, like at a party, or if there's background noise, they feel like a complete lump because the background fuses with the foreground noise like it would here. If there was a lot of background noise and I was talking, your listeners wouldn't be able to make sense out of what I'm saying. Yet if you take away the background noise, I come across very, very clear. Well, they
can't. One of your chapters. Okay, I'm sorry. Finish that.
So they have a filtering problem. And some of them, for example, are disorganized. One, because they're discoordinated not only physically but mentally. They can't prioritize. Everything they're looking at has the same importance. Of course, they do it at jobs and work, and they do it socially as well sometimes. But we're speaking about physical disorganization, but it can be mental disorganization as well.
You say something about a deaf girl can hear more clearly.
Yeah. What happens, too, is that I had a patient who was legally deaf, and she had what's called Meniere's disease, but she had two problems. The normal beep test, you have a beep, beep, and you identify, okay, I can hear the beeps or I can't hear the beeps. That's one aspect of hearing. But there's another aspect of hearing that has to do with auditory processing, like I just said, where the processing comes in scrambled. So you have two things that can impair recognition of what is heard. With the medication, I can't cure the deaf part of it, but we can improve the auditory processing component. So if you have two components that are creating a deaf problem, and we get rid of 50% of it by them being able to hear whatever they can hear more clearly, more sequenced, then it improves their overall auditory capability. And these are components that are seldom, or they weren't ever measured before.
Hal, I know that you've had enough experience with medications and that you're not a big medication guy. When you talk about possible medical treatment for inner ear disturbance, what are you talking about? What drugs?
Well, we're usually talking about the antihistamines. You know, meclizine, Dramamine, Bonine, you know, things for motion sickness. Now, the most common objection, obviously, is people say, well, you get tired on that. We don't dose them and we don't give them any medication that makes people tired because once you're tired, you blow the whole system. So you only treat people with medications that makes them more alert. Any tiredness is either medication-specific or dose-specific, and we take care of it. So the medication very often takes the rap for children getting worse on it. They don't blame the doctor. It's like somebody driving a car poorly and the car gets into an accident. You can blame the car, you can blame the lights, you can blame a lot of things. If you're driving like a drunken sailor, that's the problem. You have to coordinate what you do properly. There are also nutrients. Ginger root, for example, has the same potency for many individuals and even better than Dramamine. But it's a nutrient.
How would you use it? How would you use ginger root? What do? Just eat the root or you grind up the root?
They now sell it, and it's in a capsule. So you can grind it. You can make it yourself. If you're a chef, you can cook it. Or if you're lazy and a Jap, quote-unquote, you can just buy it in a vitamin store. Now, there are other vitamins and minerals that tend to help as well and enables the brain to function more clearly. It helps memory function a little bit. And memory is a key element in dyslexics. It was thought to be a comprehension problem. You looked at the letters and you didn't understand it. You looked at words and you didn't understand it. That was an error. Most of the time, it's an orientation problem. You mix up letters like B and D. If you mix up a letter like B and D, you have to know what a B is and a D is. You're just not sure which one it is, depending on its orientation. So it's not a concept problem. It's an orientation problem. As I said, it's a tracking problem. You lose your place. And then individuals can read a sentence fine. You give them a paragraph, they don't understand it when you ask them questions. Well, if they can answer the question asked after reading a sentence, then their concept for written symbols is perfect. They just can't remember when it gets more and more and more. So it could be a paragraph, it could be a page, it could be a chapter, or certainly long books, which is why individuals with this problem look at the end of the book first, or they like small books, or they like magazine articles. Very often they're called lazy, but laziness is just the laziness of the clinician to understand properly what a patient is experiencing.
That's so well said, because that's the biggest of the self-criticisms. See, that's what people use to beat themselves over the head, because they've been told it often enough, you're just lazy. You should be able to do this because other kids could do it. Therefore, you're lazy and there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, and one criticism of the behaviorists is it's a criticism I have against doctors in general. But, you know, it's a very, they have a compulsion, well, just stop it. Or they have an obsession, just stop it. Well, if you have coma, just stop it. Get over it. They failed to recognize the underpin that they can see, and they simplify the problem and give patients more control than they have, and it's because of a lack of insight. If you understand the problem in all its dimensions, you can better affect a successful treatment, if not a cure. And there's nothing against behavior modification people, as there are. I don't have any criticism about psychoanalysts. They've done it all. But I can do it a hell of a lot better from a lot of angles if I understand better what I'm treating, what the mechanisms are. For example, disorganization. People who are organized haven't the foggiest idea why people live in a mess. It doesn't make any sense to them because they do it instinctively. Well, what's wrong with the disorganizer? Well, first of all, as I said before, they see a whole bunch of things and they have no ability to prioritize, and they don't see one thing or another thing. They see it all, and they don't know where to start. Many of them have difficulty with starting and stopping functions, what I call. When they're reading, for example, their eyes get stuck on a letter or a word. They almost have to blink to get it off and move on. It's called perseveration. And many of them not only can't let go of something, they can't start because their eyes lose track. That's the tracking problem. Well, their mind has the same tracking. In order to go from one to another, you got to stop a function and start it and stop and start. That's what makes a sequence. They have difficulty doing that as part of the mechanism. They have difficulty prioritizing. These are the mechanisms underlying organizations. And they're psychologically or mentally discoordinated and discombobulated the way an accident-prone person is when they're walking. They're bumping into, they're stumbling, they're tripping, they're falling. Well, that's disorganization when you're moving. There's disorganization at rest. And the same inner ear mechanisms are part and parcel. Also, memory is a very, very important part of it, and distractibility. They start one function, they hear a bell ring, they turn around, they don't know where they were, and they don't know how to get started again. The distraction impairs their memory sequencing.
But there are people now, like me, who get along really well being disorganized, because I have a whole bunch of people who work with me who organize everything. So my disorganization, if you look at my desk, you'll see about 40 pieces of paper, And I can behind that be very, very creative and get an awful lot done. However, if somebody came over and lifted the pieces of paper to try to organize them, I practically lose my mind.
Yes, because you have different capabilities that people have. Some people can function only under disorganized conditions. They get wacky when things are moved. They like it the way they have it. Some need it absolutely perfect and clear. They need no clutter. It's a distraction to them to function and move on. Others feel perfectly comfortable with the mess, so to speak, and I use sure. that relatively, because it makes them more comfortable. They feel more at home with it. Now, I had a patient, for example, who was a successful multimillionaire at the age of 22, couldn't read and write. What he did is, whenever he went places, he brought his lawyer an accountant, and they didn't even know he couldn't read. So when a contract was given him, he gave it to his lawyer and said, what do you think? Then he gave it to his accountant and said, what do you think? And he had the intuitive ability to synthesize what they said and make a proper decision, or he would have been poor. So he had the ability to choose proper assistance. He had the ability to intuitively understand and digest and react to what they said. So there are tremendous numbers of ways of compensating for these various symptoms. But the better you understand your symptom, the wiser your choice of a lawyer or an accountant or assistant or how many assistants you need, really.
My guest, Harold Levinson, name of the book, Smart But Feeling Dumb, donated generously by Dr. Levinson to the WBAI during our fund drive here. We have, it's a wonderful piece of work. There's so much information in here. Before we go on, before we end, I wanted to grab 1 minute for the difference between Asperger's syndrome and what you could tell me about that from your learning.
Well, again, Asperger's syndrome is when people fail to understand other people's meaning or facial expressions or emotions or your own. And again, they have very often they're OCD, very often they're dyslexic, very often invariably they have balance and coordination problems. So they also have an inner ear cerebellar problem, the same as people who don't have Asperger's but merely dyslexia or OCD or phobias. What I came to recognize is that sometimes when I treated people for their reading problems, their social capabilities improved. They were suddenly able to see people's and read people's expressions and read their own feelings better. So when you really think of it, it's a form of social dyslexia, if you think about it. Some people have difficulty reading numbers. Some people have difficulty reading letters and words. Some people have difficulty reading feelings. And
well, got to be going now. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. I will be, next week there'll be Women's Day, so we won't have a chance to be on the air. Be back with us in 2 weeks. Or you could follow us on Facebook through thepositivemind.com. Be back with you next week, my friends.